Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games as all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
The pandemic was always going to be awful. People were going to die. Lives were going to be upended. But lately, there's been a new story about what went wrong during COVID-19. Not just that we made mistakes, but that we knew those were mistakes at the time. Or at least we should have known. That public health officials should have known that lockdowns wouldn't work. They should have known that schools shouldn't have been closed. And they should have known that all the other non-pharmaceutical interventions we made weren't actually going to be worth it. It's a thorny story. I think there's some truth to it, but I also think it can be overstated. My guest today is Roger Karma, an Atlantic journalist and a friend of mine who recently wrote a piece about what he calls COVID revisionism. We debate what that term even means, what the evidence actually shows, and what we should do the next time the world falls apart. I'm a bit harsher on the public health establishment and the political choices and discourse than Roger is, and that makes for a pretty fun debate. My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the founder and editor of The Argument, an online magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism through open debate. The Argument is against subtweeting. We engage our opponents directly and we state our opinions clearly. For an ad-free version of this episode, go to theargumentmag.com to subscribe. Well, Roger, welcome to the pod.
It's so great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So there was like no way that a global pandemic was going to go great. You know, like it's not like no one's ever going to do a retrospective on a pandemic and go like, wow, like fantastic stuff. Like we're really excited about how that played out. People are going to die. Pandemic measures, no matter how, you know, how well they work, can't save everyone, whether it's death, injury, but also just like real incursions on people's privacy, liberties, civil rights, like telling people they have to stay home and away from their family and friends. Like they can't go to the movies. They can't have birthday parties. People miss out on their weddings. I mean, religious ceremonies that are important to people. I mean, I remember in the pandemic, one of the biggest concerns was church choirs singing because singing is such a spreader of respiratory diseases in like enclosed areas. And like that brings a lot of people a lot of joy. And so like even in a situation where things had gone perfectly, that we had done all the things well, they had been mitigated well, that there was a lot of trust between the population and the scientists and the public health officials and the politicians, it's still going to be bad. But I think there's a different level of revisionism we're seeing now. We're not just seeing sort of like, okay, you know, maybe we should have shifted some policies here or there, or like this wasn't implemented in the best way and we should have different best practices that are being put into place by, public health officials. We're seeing a real view develop, I think, across the political spectrum that the pandemic prevention measures were not only not effective, but that at the time it was knowable that they were ineffective and that they were costly enough to some segments of the population that they shouldn't have been pursued. And I think this is developing in a bunch of different places, but I'm hoping that you can like lay out what this view is and like where it's coming from.
Yeah. And I think you really nailed it with that description across the political spectrum.
Yeah.
Because this sort of set of beliefs that I call COVID revisionism, I feel like has been festering on the right for a long time. And you see it in a lot of the Trump administration appointments, folks like RFK Jr., Jay Bhattacharya, who was one of the co-authors of the Great Barrington Declaration, which we might talk about later, is now leading the NIH. You have sort of right-wing COVID revisionists in very high positions of power. What struck me was that this kind of view that was emerging from the left and from sources that were the center, from the left. A lot of the books that I review in my article are center-left, you know, scholars and journalists. And what really struck me was listening to an episode of The Daily with two of the authors of this book, In COVID's Wake, Stephen Macedo and Francis Lee, and hearing a set of arguments
we
that
have
I was
the book
used
to. Right
we have it right here. That I was used to hearing from the right. And so what is that? What is COVID revisionism? I think it is this view that, like you said, it was not only that the pandemic measures caused irreparable harm, right? In addition to the ones you talked about, right? Like learning loss, huge spikes in mental health disorders, like shuttered businesses. Like this was a very traumatic thing for our society to go through. But it was not only that, it was that they were also, in addition to that, didn't actually do the thing that they were said to be doing. They weren't actually effective at saving lives. And not only that, but the people in charge knew it.
Yeah.
They knew it from the beginning.
Or at least should have known it.
They knew it from the beginning, or they should have known it based on the consensus at the time. And then that they forced them on everyone anyways. Yeah. And then as evidence piled up against them, they continued to not only double down, but silence their critics, stifle dissent, etc. And sort of that in the end, it ended up not working. And so I would say that is the sort of core constellation of beliefs that I call pandemic revisionism. Should have known that it wasn't going to work. We doubled down on it anyways. And in the end, it didn't save many lives, if any lives, and caused an irreparable amount of harm.
As our listeners can kind of hear, like, you are not on board with this with this theory of the pandemic. And I wonder if we can come in to kind of like maybe just break down these pieces. What did they know and when did they know it? And so I think that like maybe we can start from this, because I think it's hard sometimes when we're evaluating things in hindsight. Like, people can just go like, oh, are you Monday morning quarterbacking? But there's like actually a very specific claim being made that at the time people should have realized that a lot of these NPIs, which are non-pharmaceutical interventions, so things like masking, social distancing, all these things that don't that aren't like vaccines or other kind of treatments that are, are medical or pharmaceutical were not actually going to save lives. So steelman that case for me. What is the argument being made? Maybe we can just look at Macedo and Lee's argument in their book.
Great. Well, they let me think about this for one sec, how to my way in. I'm really happy you started there because I think that is one of the core claims of these books and of the revisionist narrative generally. So a lot of the claim comes down to what was the dominant consensus in the public health profession itself. The claim being made is not that these scholars, that these public health officials should have been aware of some evidentiary basis that was like outside of the bounds of what they were normally working on. It was that the dominant consensus within public health at the time that COVID hit was that these NPIs, these non-pharmaceutical interventions, would not be effective and would cause a huge amount of harm. That this was like the consensus in the profession, and that the public health officials, either because they were enamored by China's draconian response at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, some on the right claim it's because they were, it was because of a cynical desire for power. Public health officials all over the world threw out the playbook. They threw out the consensus, ignored the evidence, and imposed lockdowns anyways. And the core pieces of evidence here are a series of reports, pre-pandemic playbooks. The ones that Lee and Macedo really rely on is this 2019 report from the World Health Organization. This was published in the fall, just a few months before COVID hit. And it was built around sort of a kind of playbook as to what should we do in the case of a respiratory virus like COVID-19. And in their sort of telling, this report basically recommended, and I actually have the quote right here, they quote, "Mere months before COVID lockdowns, leading health agencies around the world recommended against the very policies that were widely embraced early in the COVID pandemic," end quote. There were and so basically the argument is, look, the WHO itself said that a bunch of these NPIs weren't going to work, that they were going to cause harm, and the public health establishment did them anyway.
Yeah. So they rely on this 2019 report to basically just say that, like, everyone knew that NPIs wouldn't work. What is the theory behind which all of these scientists and public health officials would think that it doesn't work and then choose to impose them anyway? Like, why would they do that?
So the thinking behind this is that there was a kind of collective freakout in spring of 2020.
I mean, there was.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
I freaked out.
If you actually, if you think back, right, if you, and this is a sort of charitable version.
Yeah.
If you think back to those months, we didn't know how severe this virus was. We didn't really know how transmissible it was or how fast it was spreading. it was barreling across the world. It had left Wuhan in China. It had places in Rome. It was in New York City. There was ambulances, sirens wailing, bodies piling up on the streets. And I think part of the view is that in that moment, public health officials were looking at, well, what is the one place that has tried to deal with this? It is China.
Mm-hmm.
And China did a really draconian crackdown.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, it kind of seemed like it was working. That, and so I think the charitable read, the charitable theory is that public health officials were looking at what happened in China. They didn't want to do nothing,
mm-hmm.
and decided to impose these against the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
The less charitable view, which you hear a little bit more on the right, is that public health officials for a long time have wanted to impose things that like reinforce their own power, that this was kind of a cynical desire to impose some kind of social control. There's a long strain of this in conservative sort of thinking going all the way back to sort of or in reactionary thinking, I should say. I would say that like a lot of the COVID revisionists kind of toggle between these things, but it was more or less we had some kind of irrational freak out, threw out the evidence, looked at what's happening in China and said, well, we should probably try to do that here.
So I want to put a pin in this particular part of the conversation, because I think that like me and I think you too have concerns with how a lot of COVID policy played out, which I think we'll get into later, where like I don't think either of us think that it was optimal or that we were maximally rights protective or that people were really being engaging in any kind of cost benefit analysis they should have been. But I want to like focus in on like what we actually knew at the time then, because like I do think that, as you put out in your piece, it's actually super relevant for future pandemics and for future, which are incredibly likely to happen, unfortunately, that people know whether NPIs are things that they should rely on. Like, is masking effective? Are these things helpful in conditions of uncertainty? Like, we didn't know how COVID spread in the early months. Like, it was a question about what kinds of things we should be doing. So, like, when you reviewed the evidence, looking back, you know, you set your, you know, Google time search to like before 2020, you know, when you're looking at the evidence that they're citing, et cetera, what did public health officials know? What was the debate like about NPIs?
So I think it's really helpful to ground this. And I think it is actually quite helpful that they rely so much on that 2019 WHO report, which in my reading of the evidence was a pretty good summation of what the field knew at the time. But when you actually read the report, it reads very differently than it is often portrayed by the COVID revisionists. For instance, the report actively recommends multiple NPIs.
Yeah.
It recommends against three in particular. Those are border closures, quarantines, and contact tracing, in part because, in their view, the evidence was sufficiently weak and those restrictions are very onerous. Although I will say, even in the report, it says things like, well, in the case of a really severe pandemic and like if nations really want to close their border, like it kind of makes some caveats even on those. But it basically says those three you shouldn't do. But it actively recommends school and workplace closures, face masks. It recommends like travel restrictions, all depending on sort of the severity of the outbreak. And the basic reason behind it is that the authors of that report ultimately come to the very opposite conclusion as the COVID revisionists. I'm just going to read a quote from this report, which is, even as the sort of narrative from the COVID revisionists is like, these are ineffective, they're not worth the disruption. The actual report acknowledges that the NPIs can be highly disruptive. But the conclusion they arrive at in that report is, quote, the most effective strategy to mitigate the impact of a pandemic is to reduce contacts between infected and uninfected persons, thereby reducing the spread of infection, peak demand for hospital beds, and the total number of infections, hospitalizations, and deaths, end quote. And so what you have, I think, in this report is a really interesting encapsulation. On the one hand, there were doubts about some of the evidentiary bases for some of these interventions. And that point is true. There actually is, it's really hard to run a double-blind placebo randomized control trial for something like...
We just infect a random town and see what happens.
Like, there are so many ethical considerations. in public health, they have a very specific definition of what is high quality of evidence. And then, like, unless it is a randomized control trial like that, they're not allowed to say that it's high evidence. So on the one hand, these reports are like, look, we don't know for sure that these work all the time with the highest amount of evidence, but we have enough to go off of, mm-hmm. both because of like germ theory of disease and observational data, that we're going to recommend these ones. We're going to not recommend some other ones. And that for me was a kind of good summation of the evidence at the time. There's a 2017 CDC report that was the latest one that had been done that comes mm-hmm. to similar conclusions. In the book, they cite some other reports, one from Johns Hopkins, one is a 2006 study. Those ones are a little bit more equivocal about MPIs, but are in part equivocal because they are trying to say, like, look, like, we just need to study this more. Even they are not recommending against them. So this, I think I would say that the, like, these are ineffective and only cause harm sort of read is a misrepresentation of what the actual consensus in the field was. There was an active debate, but there was no means like a dominant view that these wouldn't work.
So, like, I mean, again, like, this doesn't necessarily mean that NPIs are super effective. It just means that, like, there was actually active debate, and it doesn't yes. mean that public health officials were just looking to sort of impose lockdowns for fun. Well, that's not charitable. But impose lockdowns out of, like, a sense of wanting to control the situation, yes, and, exactly. and kind of, like, maintain their own power.
And you can imagine, right, going back to that situation that we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. put yourself back in the spring of 2020.
No.
So you, I refuse. No one wants to. We don't want to.
Yeah.
That was a horrifying time. Yeah. There was so much we didn't know. There was, things were moving so fast. In that moment, would it really, like, it's really hard to blame someone for, like, there is a virus tearing across the world. Mm-hmm. And the option is either, well, we don't totally know 100% about the robustness of the studies that have been done on these interventions, so we're going to do nothing.
Yeah.
Versus, look, we have these tools. We think they're going to work. We need to do something. I think it's a very reasonable.
I actually think that right yeah. here is exactly why I have maybe, I think, some more sympathy for the Macita Lee argument than you do. And it's the sense that, like, in times of great fear about extinction level events, not just like, oh, something really bad is happening, yeah. but like AI is going to kill us all, turn us all into paperclips, or climate change is going to lead to the mass extinction of all human animal life. Like, if you begin to posit, for good or bad reason, a coming catastrophe as existential, then it justifies basically throwing out all cost-benefit analysis. It justifies saying, you know, you should take really high-risk, high-variance strategies because, like, our normal balancing desires don't make sense if it's, we're all just going to die. If you're all just going to yeah. die if you don't fix this problem, then yeah, everyone should mask up. We should shoot you if you don't mask up. Like, literally, if you're going to kill everyone, then, like, you know, like, let's just do the most insane maximally, yeah. you know, maximally effective or maximally intrusive things yeah. if they have even the slightest chance of making it less possible that we're all going to die. And so I think Macita Lee's point, and I think a lot of the people who have concerns with COVID pandemic policies, like the NPIs, or in most cases it's stuff about like travel restrictions, yeah. school closures, not being able to go to your friend's weddings. I mean, in some countries, like, you, it was like, I had friends who were living in the UK, it was like you had like amount of time you were allowed to be outside,
yeah,
and like that's like quite, can be quite harmful for people. If you're like, I have 30 minutes where I'm allowed to leave my tiny flat in London where I share it with four other people, and like I can't go outside. Like, it's like yeah. really a lot to ask of people. And so I think this idea that, you know, okay, even if we didn't feel like there was great evidence of NPI use, there was mixed evidence, there's a big debate going on inside. The idea that like we should just go ahead and try it because of the situation, I think is actually what garners a lot of concern from folks yeah. who are on the COVID revisionism side, because I don't think we should just do something. I think that we should have these kinds of open conversations about like, okay, the cost of this is that your kids, maybe for the rest of their life, will be worse at reading. Maybe. It's possible that your kids will be behind forever in mathematics. That they, your kids in this area who are very unlikely to actually be harmed by COVID, 16 years old, 17 years old, are going to miss out on crucial socializing years. They're not going to get to go to their prom. They're not going to hang out. That's never going to happen again for them. And I do think in some respects, like, the idea and the push to get us to be more in situations of crisis aware of benefit cost analysis and to actually think through whether it's worth it to do these policies is well taken, even if I may end up disagreeing with their specific arguments about, you know, whether NPIs were really denigrated in 2019.
I think this is such an important point, and I'm glad you made it, in part because the reason I wrote this piece wasn't because there aren't very legitimate critiques of our pandemic response, mm-hmm. right? There are a lot of messaging ones, right? The messaging around masking at the beginning of the pandemic, that was totally debacled. The messaging around the George Floyd protests and the hypocrisy there.
And explain a little bit more.
Yes, the hypocrisy around the George Floyd protests, and where you had public health officials basically in all other cases saying you shouldn't socially gather, and then saying, well, we have an exception because we agree with the presuppositions of mm-hmm. this specific protest movement.
Yeah,
that was bad. That was in a lot of ways discrediting for a lot of people. And I think perhaps the biggest mistake was this failure to weigh trade-offs.
Yeah.
I think Lee and Macedo and the other COVID revisionists are at their strongest when they point to what at the time NIH director Francis Collins called the public health mindset,
mm-hmm.
which this is in a 2023 interview. Francis Collins, looking back at the pandemic, said, look, we adapted this mindset where it was lives over everything.
If you're a public health person and you're trying to make a decision, you have this very narrow view of what the right decision is, and that is something that will save a life. Doesn't matter what else happens. So you attach infinite value to stopping the disease and saving a life.
And we definitely prioritized and put saving lives on a pedestal and did not properly consider the trade-offs. We did not properly consider the cost benefit. And if that is the core message that we get from COVID revisionism, then that is a good thing. If we actively start weighing these trade-offs more thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, I think the core of COVID revisionism is about taking it a step beyond that. Actually, at some point, engaging in its own form of trade-off denialism. Mm. So something that the COVID revisionists will often do is they will critique the public health establishment, rightly so, for not considering these trade-offs well enough. And then they will go and say, but nothing worked. These interventions, there's no evidence behind them. There was no benefit. They didn't even save a single life, based on what I think is pretty flawed evidence. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, they're making the same version of the mistake, right? They're saying implicitly, we should not consider trade-offs.
Yeah.
These interventions are all bad and no good. And mm-hmm. I think actually the place we need to come as a society is the point that you just came. We can acknowledge these have benefits. They are good at reducing infections and I think deaths. And they're also really costly. And so we have to weigh both whether we do them and how we do them. But I think that's it's a very different conversation to have, to like, how can we, and we can talk about it, like, how can we do these measures more effectively? How can we properly weigh the trade-offs? That's the conversation we should be having, not arguing over who knew what at the beginning mm-hmm. and sort of whether they were effective at all, which I think are claims that have just a lot less rigor behind them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that was extremely well put. And what I would love is for you to now walk us through why you believe NPIs were actually effective. Because I think that part of their argument rests on this idea that, like, now looking back on these years, we don't actually see. And there are some studies that they're citing that show that NPIs weren't effective at actually saving lives. That all the masking mm-hmm. you did, all those stickers you stood on that were 6 feet apart from people, that didn't save anyone's life.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really important. We should walk through the evidence on that. The one thing I will say quickly also is you have this really good point that they make too about this idea of existential threats
mm-hmm.
and not getting too lost in the idea of something being existential such that we throw out everything else we know.
Yeah.
I also think it is particularly tricky in the situation in which you have a pandemic that operates on the logic of exponentials. The idea at the beginning of the pandemic was, if we can flatten the curve, you might remember that the phrase might give people just like
trauma, like
PTSD. Just hearing it. But the whole idea was like, we don't know how fast this is spreading. If we can just hunker down and do this temporarily, like for long enough, we can get cases down low enough to where we can not overwhelm our hospital system.
Yeah.
So that's what I think that's at the beginning. But then we get to this point of, well, we didn't just keep them in place for the spring of 2020. And you know, in the end, were they even effective? And so we can also just
But I mean, I think I'll say here is that, like, there are lots of times that people indicate that they're willing to sacrifice lives for benefits that may seem trivial when discussed openly. Like, all the time. The fact that we allow massive SUVs to go at 25, 30 miles an hour through small, quiet neighborhoods. I mean, it's one of the largest killers of children. I mean, no one actually, like, puts into law, I'm okay with the SUV killing, like, 10 kids a year in my neighborhood. That's, like, a high number. But no one puts that into law. But that is the implicit trade-off that every... And honestly, like, if you were to try to implement the kinds of policies that would make that not possible, I think you'd find them quite unpopular. If you're saying, like, we're banning all large vehicles in the United States of America, like... you would, like, lose 20,000 elections.
Think about how popular,
you know?
Soda tax is.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Like, and so I think that in many
we
respects...
We do this all the time.
We do this. And so I think that, like, there's a level here where I think sometimes, not just public health, like, professors and individuals who are experts are, like, doing the math. And they're going, a life has to be worth something. And they literally do this. You have to, like, you have to have a cost of a life in order to weigh it against the other benefits that you're trying to get through regulation. And to them, it seems ridiculous. And when you say it out loud, it seems ridiculous, right? Like, no one would ever say, like, I'm pro my president saying I'm okay with people dying so that you can drink large sodas chock full of, like, whatever, like cane sugar. And so, but I do think that, like, the implicit truth is that the public health community is often kind of, during the pandemic, I think the public health community often didn't care enough about the small joys that people actually put a lot of benefit into. Having a big truck, I don't own a car. Like, it's not really that important to me to own a car. I like living in a walkable community. Yeah. But, like, some people love owning a big car. Like, this is, like, the thing that makes them really happy is having a big car. And, like, I can think that that's dumb, but that doesn't mean that that's valueless to that person. Yeah. So if I'm taking some amount of value from you, it should be agreed upon by you that what you're getting in return, you know, has some value too. And, like, obviously you can't work in a system where, like, every individual person agrees. But I do think that there's something here where, you know, people weren't enough, didn't care enough about, like, okay, you don't get to sing with your choir. A lot of, you know, non-religious public health officials got to make a decision that that wasn't that important to you.
Yeah.
And, like, it was important to you, you know?
Yeah.
So, but to move back to, like, this question about NPIs, I do think that it's worth going through as you do, why you think they actually did work, because that actually is a big problem for the COVID revisionists.
Yeah. No, I'm glad. I think this point about trade-offs is so important, and being able to properly weigh the trade-offs is the thing we need to be able to do. And that's why this argument that NPIs were completely ineffective is so damaging. Because if that's the case, right, if we name, that would be like saying that seatbelts are completely ineffective, right? If seatbelts were completely ineffective and saved no lives, like, why would we be adding this restriction onto people? And so I think it's really important to take this argument seriously. The argument that NPIs didn't work is based on the state-by-state analyses. So Lee and Macedo do their own one. They rely on a few other ones. All of these analyses basically show the same thing, which is that up until vaccines, so if we're just looking at the 2020 period, the mortality rates, age-adjusted, population-adjusted, between red and blue states were effectively the same, even though blue states kept their restrictions in place for 2.5 times longer and had much harsher restrictions.
So basically, the rate at which people were dying in blue states versus red states is the same, despite the fact that blue states were more likely to have these really harsh COVID pandemic measures.
Exactly. Okay. So blue states had much more harsher restrictions.
Well, that would be bad if
red states
true.
Had less restrictions. And in the end, pretty similar aggregate death count prior to vaccination. After vaccination, in these studies, you see a big divergence. But that would imply that the pre-vaccine measures didn't work so well. That is a pretty devastating claim.
Yeah.
And the problem is, again, when you actually dig into these studies, the actual data gets a little bit more murky. And the first issue is one of timing, right? So you might remember, COVID did not hit the entire United States equally in the spring of 2020. It hit first and foremost in the Northeast, in places like New York and New Jersey and Massachusetts, which are very heavily blue.
Yeah.
The statistic actually shocked me that in between February and the end of May in 2020, 56% of COVID deaths were in the Northeast, which only has, and that place only has 17% of the population.
Wow.
The South, which is heavily red, has 38% of the population and only had 18% of the deaths. So you see this huge divergence. Blue states getting hit hard before they're even, many of them are even able to put measures in place. The virus is already circulating. They get hit really hard. What do you see after the end of May? You see the death counts in blue, northeastern blue states plummet and red southern states spike.
Okay.
And so if you're just looking in aggregate, you might say, oh, look, this is, and at the end of the day, they ended up having pretty similar fatality numbers. But you could also tell us in a, you could also tell a story of, well, wait a minute, the blue states got hit first really hard. Then they clamped down, put in tight restrictions and saw their cases fall. And red states, which didn't get hit hardest first, ended up loosening their restrictions early and then saw their cases spike. So in the end, they look similar, but timing actually matters a lot. Now, there are still exceptions to this because I put this to Lee and Macedo and they brought up, well, there are states like, for example, Florida and California. Neither of them were in the Northeast. They got hit at pretty similar times. And Florida ended up looking pretty good at the end of it. And California did not. And California had way harsher restrictions. So how do you explain, outside of those regional variances, how do you explain California and Florida? And here, it was really interesting to call up one of the authors and a few of the authors of these studies that Lee and Macedo cite to say, like, well, what do you make of this? And I did that with Thomas Bolicki, who is the head, an epidemiologist and the head author of one of these studies. And when I told him sort of the way that his study was being used to cast doubt on MPIs, he told me he was having an Annie Hall moment.
Can I say this? Everyone keeps referencing this Annie Hall moment. And I think we should, I feel like we should play it for the audience right now.
Well, you don't know anything about Marshall McLuhan's work.
Really, really. I happen to teach a class at Columbia called TV, Media, and Culture. So I think that my insights into Mr. McLuhan, well, have a great deal of validity.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Well, that's funny because I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here. So, yeah, just let me come over here a second.
Oh, I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. You mean my whole fallacy is wrong. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
It is a scene of this movie Annie Hall in which some very snobby individual is making like a very, what they think is a high-minded point, citing the media theorist Marshall McLuhan.
Yeah.
And then they turn around and it's Marshall McLuhan is standing right there.
Yeah.
And then he comes in and is basically like, you're getting my point completely wrong. So he's having,
brutal.
So yes. So Tom is having this experience of like, it's crazy that like my work is being used this way. And the reason is because what actually you see when you look at these studies is even if you don't see the big gap in mortality, you see a huge difference when it comes to infections. So the least restrictive states by MPIs had around 30% more infections than the most restrictive states. That is a huge number, like 30% infection rate, like difference. Like these measures were clearly very effective at reducing infections. And in Bolicki's sort of summation, the reason he was having the Annie Hall moment was because he was like, but like, that's exactly what they were designed to do. They were designed to stop infections. My question to him was, well, why aren't they showing up in mortality then?
Yeah.
Part of it might be this regional story, but what he told me was that there's one just like a wonky set of things where it's like actually at the state level really hard to control for some of the intermediating factors. So like things like pre-existing health conditions, health insurance rates.
But like we would expect blue states to be healthier in those respects, right?
It's basically with certain subpopulations.
Okay.
So it's like, if you had 40 people not masking in one state and 60 people not masking in another state, that subpopulation of non-maskers might look different from one state to the other. And it's hard to control for like, what if there were more people masking in California, but the people masking in California were less healthy?
Gotcha.
And it's like, it's hard to control at that subpopulation level. But the bigger one, the bigger point here is that there's a difference between policy and behavior.
Mm-hmm.
We all know this intuitively. I spent the pandemic across multiple states. I was like with my parents in California at one point. I was in DC. I wasn't paying attention to like what the exact policy guidelines were at any given time.
Yeah.
I would like to determine my behavior. And when Bolicki and his co-authors actually looked at Florida as a case study, what they found was that even though Florida loosened its restrictions early, it had had very tight restrictions early on. And people in Florida who are disproportionately old and vulnerable, they tended to continue to follow those restrictions at higher rates than most other states. Mm-hmm. So even though Florida, at a policy level, didn't have very tight restrictions, people kept following the policy. And so one way to say this is, well, look, like, the policies didn't work. But the other way to say it is the policies were so effective that they kept people voluntarily complying to the point that it actually now in the data looks like they didn't work.
Well, the way that I would say this actually is, like, at least because I remember a lot of the research about this around how people stopped going out to restaurants and stopped. Mm-hmm. They were looking at cell phone data, like Yelp reservations and stuff like that. And you're able to see that people, before a lot of these policies and stay-at-home orders were put in place, mm-hmm. people were voluntarily doing this. And I think this is actually, like, a plus in the COVID revisionism column, because I think in many respects what it's saying is, yes, NPIs do work, but you don't actually need to impose the power of the state, whether the threat is financial through fees, the threat is jail time or whatever it was, not that that was happening in kind of like a mass way, but like you don't actually need the state to force people to do this. You can actually just present people like, hey, this is the threat. Here are the tools available to you. Like, most people weren't getting like government issued masks. Like, you know what I mean? Like, eventually that was actually a very helpful program from the Biden administration to get to be able to access those. But like, people were, like, the Etsy boom of a homemade a cloth mask, which we found out later was not that actually effective, but like, people were willing to try stuff. So I think in some respects, like, I mean, I think that the macro point you're making, like, I think is actually quite devastating to the COVID revisionism column, because I think it does indicate that the NPIs were very effective. But I think at a future lessons point, which I think is where you're really focused on in your piece, it does indicate to me that people do have a willingness to take on some costs if they're afraid of their own lives and lives of their community members being harmed. And then we should rely on that more, rather than, I think, a lot of the shaming techniques, a lot of the attempts to use kind of like negative coercion were maybe not necessary and potentially just counterproductive.
So I think that is a really important point. I think where it gets tricky, though, is it's hard to separate out how people are changing their behavior as a response to policy as a signal, as opposed to what they would have done in a retrospective world where the policy didn't exist, right? It is hard to do this with Florida because it's like they didn't end up experiencing the pandemic until a lot of restrictions were already in place. But it's hard to know, would those Floridians have continued to follow social distancing priorities, stay at home, or would they have continued to restrict their movement? So if this signal from policymakers was like, this is all voluntary, I think that is, the question is, in my view, is that policies like this send a strong signal that like, this is the important thing to do. This is what you should do if you're trying to avoid getting infected. And we are going to place a high priority on this. And that is what ends up getting people to continue to comply afterwards. Whereas maybe if you just said, look, we think you should do this, but we're not going to make you. I don't know if people would have the same response. And the example I would use here is actually one that COVID revisionists love to use, which is Sweden. So the ultimate example that often is cited by COVID revisionists as a theory of like why NPIs weren't necessary is that Sweden, very early on in the pandemic, decided to make the decision, we are not going to mandate NPIs. Like, we're going to take this approach that I think you just obviously like said, it makes a lot of sense. We're going to rely on people to voluntarily do this stuff. Sweden never closed schools, workplaces, restaurants. They didn't mandate masks. They didn't restrict people's movement until a little bit later, which we'll get to. And the story from the COVID revisionists is, well, at first, Sweden was made into this pariah. Yeah. You probably remember stories of like how irresponsible of them for doing this. And then at the end of the pandemic, Sweden has one of the lowest excess mortality rates of all of Europe. And so isn't that proof that like actually people voluntarily abiding by these things works out just fine? And I think the problem with that is there's a lot of time between like imposing the measures in 2020 and the very end of the pandemic, which is often like 2022, 2023. If you look at Sweden's 2020 record, which again, this is important. It's important to look at it pre-vaccine because that gives you the best indication of how they did on their NPIs. If you look at Sweden in 2020, they had a death rate that was 5 times higher than Finland, 12 times higher than Norway and 75 times higher than Denmark, which is like all their closest peer countries. And so that is what gives me pause. Sweden ends up catching up because they have a very successful vaccination rollout, whereas a lot of their peers like Finland really botched their vaccinations. But like, if you took this...
Isn't that really an argument against Sweden's policy? Like, I think the real problem here is just that like, there's not actually a correct answer. It's like a question of like values and judgment. Like, I personally am like, I think that we should have tried to save a lot. I'm willing to give up a lot of freedoms in order to, save lives. Like, I saved home voluntarily. Like, we had I was lucky enough to be able to work from my home and everything like that. But like, you know, would I give up the right to practice my religion if it necessitated me going in person? Like, my religion doesn't require me to do that. But like, if it did, like, maybe I wouldn't be able to willing to give that up. And maybe I'm like, okay, at the end of the day, we were able to use a voluntary system that had maybe had a few more deaths in the beginning, but by the vaccination campaign managed to actually equalize out. And so we had all these freedoms we retained, and we still had the same number of people die. Like, I feel like that's in many ways like an argument in Sweden's favor.
I think so. At the beginning of the vaccination campaign, Sweden had a much higher death rate.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's important to remember, I think the conclusion from that would be, if Sweden had done more restrictive measures, if they had similar policies as a lot of their neighbors, they would have probably had a lot, even fewer people die. And because, like, they had this great vaccine rollout, but they had a lot of people die before that.
But isn't there a possibility that the vaccine, like, one of the problems that, you know, people are really worried about now, I mean, we're talking about this in a moment of, like, real crisis of faith for public health and public health institutions, is this worry that we've lost so much trust in our government and in our institutions such that, like, we're not going to trust them to tell us to get vaxxed. We're not going to go ahead and do it. Like, we're not going to get boosted on the schedule they tell us to do it. And it, you know, again, like, a lot of this is speculation. I think that's part of what's hard here is that, like, even at this moment, there's like a ton of uncertainty about why things happened and played out in certain places than differently than others. And like, Sweden's a very different context of a government, of a society than the United States is. But I think it like, one of the arguments the COVID revisionists make is that trust in these institutions to tell you to go get vaccinated and to actually implicate and to infringe on your bodily autonomy through vaccine mandates in some respects requires a level of trust that was eroded by many of these policies to begin with, because they were out of step with the values of many of the people that were being forced to engage in these measures. So I guess my question to you is just like, I feel like it's actually up in the air whether the Sweden is a lesson for for your side of the aisle or for the Macedo. No,
that's a really interesting point. I think the important point to make about Sweden too is like extremely high levels of social trust, right? This is one of the things about the Nordic countries. It's one of the reasons why it's also hard to compare Sweden to like the rest of Europe as opposed to the other Nordics, because that is a society with extremely high levels of social trust. And actually, the number one predictor of COVID death rate over everything else was social trust. Like, that is like one of the best empirical findings, to your point, from the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a separate question of, did MPIs erode trust and that led to a more polarized vaccine uptake? If that were the case, I would have expected to see more vaccine hesitancy in other countries that also had very strict responses, and we didn't. Vaccine hesitancy was by and large an American problem. And it was an American problem in large part because we had an entire party, the Republican Party, that turned against vaccination. I think that was like, when you look at, again, the whole world, we have a lot of places that have very strict measures, a lot of places where people were not always happy about those measures, but it's in the US in particular where we see this very polarized vaccine response. That said, your broader point of how public health officials inculcate a sense of trust so that when on the things that matter most, people trust them is a really important one. Should it be the case that like we pick and choose our battles more, such that if we know vaccines are going to be extremely effective, we want to save as much trust and salvage as much trust in that intervention? And if we think it's really important to, say, mandate vaccines, then maybe we don't want to put a bunch of mandates on people first. We really want to just focus on the vaccines. I think that is a tactical question. That is a really important question for public health officials to reckon with, because even the people like me who push back against the MPIs didn't work framing, MPIs worked a hell of a lot worse than vaccines did. Yeah. Vaccines were the saving grace of this. And MPIs worked only insofar as they delayed infections long enough to get us to the vaccines. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a really important point that I hope the way that these books are taken is that public health officials are more willing to grapple with what exactly enables them to maintain trust mm-hmm. so that they can spend that trust and that capital wisely. What I worry about with COVID revisionism is that it's doing the opposite, is that they're making these arguments ostensibly in service of defending public health. But in doing so, if your core narrative is these people knew from the beginning this wouldn't work, and that out of a cynical desire for power or an admiration for China, they imposed this all on you anyway. They ignored the evidence. They were hyper-partisan. They were in cahoots with the media and with teachers' unions, etc., which comes across in these books. Are you going to trust those same public health officials to tell you about vaccines? What I'm getting at is I think trust is really important. I think public health officials did a lot to undermine their own trust. But I think it's, again, one of those cases where now the COVID revisionists are undermining that trust even further in a way that ends up being damaging, even if part of the...
I also think that part of this is I want to like separate out things where it's we are critiquing the past in order to have a better future, and where we're saying they should have known better.
Yeah.
I think with the vaccines strategy that, you know, I laid out and that you just explained about further too, around, you know, maybe you want to save your trust for the vaccines. Like, we didn't know how effective those COVID vaccines were going to be. Like that was kind of a miracle. Like, good vaccines can be like 60% effective.
We
like,
also had no idea when we were going to get them.
Yeah, I think we got that fast. I don't even think it's like, oh, at the time they should have known. I don't want to make it sound
forward.
Yeah, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, people should have known that, you know, the vaccines were going to be great. They were going to come with me. It was going to be possible to even send them out to all those people that quickly. But I do think that, you know, this broader point about how do you inculcate trust and how do you do disagreement and how do you have a reconciliation process and also an acknowledgement of the pain and the unfairness that was borne by, honestly, I think the strongest point that these books make and the revisionists make is that the cost of the pandemic were disproportionately borne by the least well-connected, by the most marginalized populations, and by people who had the least political power eventually a Democratic president. But as you note in your piece, everyone forgets in 2020, Trump was president. I think that in many respects here, like the idea that, you know, people who are pushing back on the public health establishment now are contributing to a loss in public trust, I think could end up being another way of silencing that speech, which I think is also, you know, I don't think there's like an easy way to get the U.S. to become a high trust country. Yeah. If there was, I think people would just do it. But I do think that part of the problem is that there's this belief that you should prevent yourself from saying things you believe are true because you're playing 3D chess. I mean, this is usually referred to as like noble lies. Like you're just not going to say what you think is real because you're afraid of it. It's like second order, third order consequences down the road if people hold on to that. So I think a good example of this, which you have given before, is this idea about, you know, them trying to people telling us that masks weren't that effective because they wanted to keep them for first responders. And like, that's bad because you just shouldn't lie to people. But also, like, it actually then when you wanted people to mask up, they were like, you just told me it didn't matter. And also you kind of feel like, oh, like I'm like a guinea pig. Like you've decided that my life is less important than a first responder's. And like, yes, we should save those masks for first responders because they're the ones in the most danger, not because your life is worthless. But that's heard differently from a population that is in that does not believe that you're looking out for them. And so I think that like I'm a little worried about a view that you're advancing here at the end of your remarks around like we shouldn't push back on this because it's going to reduce public trust.
I'm so happy you brought up that point because I think you're so right. I think there absolutely has to be a conversation about what I've come to think of as trade-off denialism.
Mm-hmm.
Getting to the roots of why the public health establishment was so willing to deny trade-offs and so willing to look past a lot of these harms. I really do think this gets to an intrinsic bias in the public health profession towards life over everything else, mm-hmm. right? You will talk to some public health officials and they'll say, look, I swore a Hippocratic oath. And that is true. And that is often why, actually, I think it is important for policymakers not to uncritically just listen to public health officials, who usually are the ones who are thinking about life first and foremost. And they have to be the ones, the politicians and the public health, the policymakers who take that side of what can we do to save life, and also think about the broader social context and say, like, no, like, we're not going to keep schools closed.
Yeah.
I think that's a really valid point. What I'm worried about is not the critique of the public health profession. I think that's really important. What I'm worried about is a narrative that the public health profession is a bunch of self-serving ideologues that you shouldn't trust no matter what.
Yeah.
So, like, a lot, I talked to a lot of epidemiologists for this, a lot of public health officials for this. They were all so self-critical.
Yeah.
They were all so like we messed up. We messed up. I think we messed up on a lot of messaging stuff that we talked about. We kept schools closed for too long.
Yeah.
I had some very high profile ones being like, we shouldn't have done vaccine mandates. That was a mistake.
Wow. Yeah.
Because of how much it polarized people against us.
Mm-hmm.
There is a real reckoning, I think, within the public health profession about this. I think that that reckoning needs to happen in public. I think there needs to be criticism. I think it's when you assign your critics bad faith, when you assign your critics sort of a caricatured view about their intentions and why they were doing it, then you create this kind of cynical conspiracism where I can't trust anything they say. And
it's
kind of
populism, you know, in many respects too, like, which is interesting coming from like center left technocrats, you know, it's like.
And this is why writing this article was so tough for me, because I buy a lot of the analysis about the critiques of the public health establishment and also don't want to see it be so irreparably, so irredeemably sort of undermined that we can never rebuild it back up again. And here's the kind of thing I think that, like, the kind of conversation we could be having, like, let's go back for a second to the effectiveness around MPIs.
Mm-hmm.
There is a case to be made that even if you don't buy those state-by-state analyses, which have a lot of problems, these MPIs should have been more effective.
Yeah.
But then the question is, what follows from that? Well, maybe you want to ask, why weren't they as effective as we wanted them to be? And if you ask that, then it's like, well, wait a minute. We actually know that it's not the inherent policies themselves. We know from germ theory of disease that if we are in different rooms, if we are separating by distance, we're going to be less likely to spread a disease to one another. The problem is, actually, when you dig into the data of, like, why these weren't as effective as they could have been, it's because people got fatigued. People stopped, like, they lasted for long enough such that people eventually were just like, look, I know my school is closed, but, like, my kid needs to see their friends. One reason that school closures, for example, didn't reduce community transmission as much as people thought was because actually kids were hanging out outside of school because the measure was so fatiguing, and so people weren't able to last long enough such that they started breaking them. The thing I worry about is if you buy the COVID revisionist argument, they say we should just throw all of this out.
Yeah.
But if you're actually wrestling with, okay, what worked and why did it work and how can we build trust, these kinds of questions, you might say a snow day model, which is something that public health experts have talked to, which you only snap restrictions into place when case counts get high enough in a community such that the hospital system has the potential to be overwhelmed. And otherwise,
automatic stabilizers for NPIs.
This is
love
literally
it. Everything automatic should be automatic stabilizers.
But look, and that's what I think is, like, that kind of approach, like a snow day model approach, feels like a really nice in between of, let's only put these in place when we think that we are getting close to a point where we could have our hospital systems overwhelmed, minimize cost, try to maximize benefits. That's very different from saying we should just throw all of it out.
So one thing I want to point to is the alternative approach advanced by Macedo and Lee and a lot of other people who are on the side of the COVID revisionists is that we should have restricted NPI use and restrictions to the highest risk populations, and the rest of the populations should have just kind of maybe given recommendations. So, like, you know, we knew pretty early on that older people were the ones who were, like, greatly at risk. We knew pretty early on that, like, young, healthy people who don't have pre-existing conditions, even if they got sick, it didn't seem likely that there was going to, it was going to lead to mortality or like even severe illness, right? Like that mm-hmm. was like known within a couple of months of the pandemic, but also just like kind of known in general that younger and healthier people are less likely to die. Even if we're not super aware of the rates of which that mm-hmm. disease happened. Like even if you're like less likely to die, if it's 10% chance, you're probably still going to like stay home and not talk to people. So I think that like, you know, I find this like not that insane, but like you, I think don't have a lot of, you don't have a lot of sympathy for this view.
I'm glad you brought it up. And this comes up in my piece sort of in the context of the Great Barrington Declaration.
Can you explain what that is?
Yeah. So this comes up in the piece in the context of the Great Barrington Declaration, which Leon Macedo spent a lot of time discussing. For those outside of the Wonka sphere who might not remember this, this was a basically a letter published in October of 2020 by three sort of prominent lockdown skeptical scientists, one of which is Jay Bhattacharya, who is now the head of NIH. And it basically made this argument that we should do what they called focus protection, which is kind of what you just outlined, which is we should focus on the most vulnerable among us. We should, for example, increase staffing in nursing homes and really focus on nursing homes. And we should basically let everyone else go back to normal. Like we should reopen restaurants and after school activities and schools and workplaces. And basically that will allow us to get to a point to achieve herd immunity that will allow us to sort of glide to the end of the pandemic. And I think my problem with that argument is it sounds great in theory, like focus protection. Like, of course, we should be focusing on the most vulnerable mm-hmm. and not on the people who are like healthy and probably not at huge risk anyway. And the problem I just kept coming to with this every time I would bring it up to like an actual public health person was this is just really difficult to do in practice. It's just really hard when you have in the US, we have 90 million people. 90 million, more than a quarter of the population that is either over 65 or has some kind of pre-existing condition that makes them vulnerable to COVID. Those people work with, they live with, they play with, they like interact with all the other people who are not as vulnerable to the virus. And so you see in like lots of different countries that try to do this approach, infections always end up spilling over to the vulnerable population. It's just really difficult, especially in a country which is that is as old and has as high of rates of things like chronic illnesses as we do. It's really, really
but I
hard
think
to do this.
We should be comparative here, right? Because you're right that it's hard, mm-hmm. but like there's 90 million on one hand and then there's 330 million on the other hand. And like the idea that like, you know, the country tried to do this, there was spillover into the rest of the population. Like the countries that didn't do it, there was also spillover of vaccines. So I guess like from a comparative perspective, I guess I'm kind of view it like, again, I think there are reasons why you wouldn't want to do this because maybe you view the level of the death rate as unacceptably high, even mm-hmm. in the non-vulnerable populations. Like there are concerns other than that about long-term damage from viral infections, repeat viral infections. Yeah. Like being sick is bad anyway. A lot of people don't want to be sick. And also just like, you know, people should often have underlying conditions they don't know about. So like, how do you target it? Whatever. So like, there are lots of things, reason why you want to do this. But like, I think the idea that it's easier to lock down all of society than the parts that are most vulnerable seems like not true to me.
So I think what you would have to acknowledge if you were just going to do a focus protection strategy is just you are more or less the restrictions, the quote unquote restrictions that you put in place on the vulnerable just aren't going to be very effective at protecting the vulnerable. And so again, it goes back to costs and benefits. Do you say we are going to create more spillover risk to the mm-hmm. vulnerable populations and probably accept a much higher level of death? Or do you say we are going to minimize risk to those populations by shutting down larger swaths of society, knowing that it's going to be, that's like the only surefire way to do it, probably get less death, but get a lot wider societal damage. I'm not in a position to make that call. The reason I think the Great Barrington Declaration is actually a terrible example of this mm-hmm. is because it came out so close to when we had vaccines. Mm. If there is any time when you want to have a more lockdown, let's just hunker down approach, it is when we're a couple months away from vaccination. I actually think the Great Barrington Declaration argument was much stronger in like April or May of 2020. Mm-hmm. We don't know when we're going to get vaccines. Do we really want to just lock down indefinitely and in order to protect the vulnerable populations and risk harm for everyone else? In October, we were already getting a lot of signs that we were going to have vaccines by the end of the year. We were going to have mm-hmm. shots in arms. The administration itself was saying this. Lots of other public health folks. We had that same month a lot of initial Pfizer data coming out. Like, we were right around the corner from having vaccination. And that is like, I think that is a time when actually the trade-offs become a little bit less difficult, because it's like, wait a minute, if this becomes now goes from a long-term strategy to a short-term, let's just do this for a little while longer till we get the vaccines, It's actually the worst time to be making the like argument that would be, let's just let everyone live life.
So I think that the reaction to Great Barrington and the reaction to a lot of the COVID skeptics or the COVID mitigation measure skeptics saying their views in social media as part of politics, I mean, that reaction to them, which was, there was a pretty big backlash. Socially, professionally, in the press, against a lot of people who were advocating less maximalist COVID policies, was pretty extensive. And I wonder, like, what your view is, because I think that a lot of the point that's being made around, we need to develop scientific communities that are resilient in times of pressure to the stifling of dissenting opinions. And that's a big part of this Macedo and Lee book. It's a big part of the concern right now. Like, a lot of the backlash right now is just like, okay, well, like, you guys didn't even let us have a conversation about the cost and benefits and the trade-offs that you're laying out here. Like, this conversation we're having right now, which is still critical of the COVID restriction, is, would have been like cancel worthy like if we had this in 2020. Like, it would have been quite bad. I'm not sure we would have had it in the same open way as a result of that. And so I think that, like, in some respects, I guess, like, do you buy at least the criticism that the public health communities, the journalism institutions, the political institutions, the activist organizations, just most people speaking out in public were insufficiently open at times to the critique that they were being leveled, and I mean, maybe even specifically the Great Barrington document.
I think that's a hugely important point, and I think there is a real, the thing that is tricky about COVID revisionism is like how many deep and profound kernels of truth there are in it. And I think your description of this was right. I think there was a lot of unfortunate unwillingness to listen to opposing views, a lot of people who felt like they couldn't say what was on their mind. Are, you know, how should I describe Derek? Should I say now?
Our colleague.
Our colleague.
Our columnist, only known for being a columnist at The Argument. No other accolades, Derek Thompson.
My former and your current colleague, Derek Thompson, has written about the way that the pandemic warped our politics. And a big reason was this exact point that so many people, whether it was like folks in the Maha RFK Jr. world, folks in the sort of Manosphere podcast world, people that ended up being core parts of Trump's eventual coalition, felt like they couldn't speak their minds. Like there were interventions being forced upon them and they had no say in the matter. I definitely think there's a kernel of truth there. I also think the revisionists take it too far. So I will concede that around the Great Barrington Declaration, there was a lot of backlash. And in their book, Lee and Macedo really focus on this email exchange between Francis Collins, who is the head of the NIH at the time, and Tony Fauci, who we all know. And Collins calls for a quick and devastating takedown. I'm doing air quotes. Collins calls for a, quote, quick and devastating takedown, end quote, of the Great Barrington Declaration. And this is sort of in COVID revisionist spheres, like the smoking gun. And then a couple days later, you get this John Snow memorandum, it's now called, which is signed by like 7,000 scientists, basically taking down the Great Barrington Declaration. And I, you know, and this was sort of the response from the official public health establishment. When you actually look at that response, though, right, there were a lot of, you know, people on social media, in the press, like kind of bad-mouthing the Great Barrington authors. But when you look at the official response, if you even just, Francis Collins, I spoke to him for this piece, and he said he regretted using the phrase quick and devastating takedown, but he didn't regret pushing back. And if you look at, actually you read all of their email exchange, it's them like exchanging articles from Wired, because they're like trying to figure out like, which arguments to use. It's not like they were like, we need to stop these people from talking. It was like, we need to present the best counter argument to this case before it basically gets in front of the Trump administration, and the Trump administration actually uses it to affect policy that we think is going to possibly harm people's lives. If you look at the Jon Snow memorandum, which is the official kind of public health community response, it is like, you reading the COVID revisionist, you'd think this would be like an ad hominem filled, like spicy attack. It is like a very boring, like, this is why herd immunity is not backed up by the science, like very point by point response. So I think there's kind of these, what makes this difficult is there's these like dual responses. There's like quick and devastating takedown. There's all this stuff that's happening on social media. And then on the other hand, there's like this, the actual response itself is this very measured, debating on the merits, which looks kind of like the marketplace of ideas in action. And I think the problem is that, like, because of the sort of modes of discourse we're in, the Twitter conversation got very elevated and very amplified, which was, I think, at times very stifling. The official response was much more debating on the merits. And then those two kind of get fused, and the latter sort of gets forgotten as opposed to the former. And so this is me wrestling out loud with the fact that I think that you're right. And also, I don't think the public health establishment as a whole was like really trying to squash or silence dissent, that it was a combination of like the algorithmic social media ecosystem that we operate in, the loud voices getting amplified by that, that like kind of created this cacophony that was hard to overcome. And that's it's really messy to sit in that.
Yeah.
And it's much less satisfying than like it was this group of people who wanted to silence speech. But I think we have to sit in that messiness.
I think, you know, it raises to me the very questions we're wrestling with here at the argument about what liberalism is. Mm. Because if you were to grade, you know, like the public health community based on their submitted work, right? Like, and I went to go like skim some of the, you know, the reports you're talking about here. And you're right. They're like, they're quite, they're not being like, we should never allow these people to talk. Let's strip them of their like degrees. Like they're not allowed to be in polite society ever again. You know, and that's true. But I think that, like, I mean, this is something that everyone across the political spectrum will say, including people who are on, you know, who are on the left, who are activists, who are in many of the communities that are using the power of, you know, how they will call it, the power of speech to push back against views and ideas that they find reprehensible. And there's this question, right? Like, is free speech just the government not preventing you from being able to talk? Or is free speech also a culture and a way of engaging with people that indicates openness to viewpoints that you find maybe even abhorrent? And like, let's say in this conversation, like, you know, if I invited you on this podcast, if I invited you to my living room here in my home, and, you know, we have a disagreement about something that is like actually quite serious, like millions of people died, like future pandemics, tens of millions of people die. When we're talking about policy, we're talking about the environmental catastrophe that could happen with climate change, that could happen with AI. Like, it makes sense for people to be heated and to be angry and to be afraid, because the implication, if I'm right and you're wrong about these topics, is that more people will die if they listen to you. And so that creates a weird problem, right? Because I'm like, I think I'm right, obviously, because that's why I'm saying my views. And that's why I started a whole company talking about why I'm right all the time. But, you know, at the same time, like, I think that, like, part of what needs to be, I think, more of, like, a cultural shift is that there's the idea that, like, maybe I'm wrong needs to be, like, more foreground in my head. Like, I really think I'm right. And, like, I think in many respects, that's what the public health officials you're talking to are doing, is, like, how do we inculcate this sense that, like, maybe I should have some level of epistemic humility around these questions, even if I am an expert, even if I have, like, 20 years in virology and you know, and studying epidemics in all these different contexts, like, inculcating that, but also just, like, this question then of, like, was it just free speech that we were shouting all of these people down? Was that just us using our free speech? And I think that, like, an easier way to talk about this is not trying to talk about whether or not it's free speech or not, but it's to say, like, is this the culture that we want our truth-seeking institutions to exhibit?
Like, a culture of pluralism is what you're talking about.
But, like, they, you know, Macedo and Lee, like, they put, like, journalism, academia, government, like, public health and scientific institutions, like, truth-seeking institutions, maybe they're adhering to the letter of the law. They're like following the rules in their specific communications in the public journals and in JAMA and all these places where they're publishing.
Yeah.
But when it comes to how they're behaving and how they're creating a culture within their own communities and friend groups and networks and in politics and on TV and in podcasts, are they inculcating the sense that, like, if you disagree with them, they think that you're like not a part of the community anymore?
Yeah. No,
yeah,
I think
free speech for us, right?
No,
there.
I think that the COVID revisionist critiques go a little bit far when they talk about this very strong language of silencing opposition and stifling dissent. But do I think that in 2020, the kind of discourse culture we had cultivated around public health and many other issues was ideal for a truth-seeking society, especially in the midst of a pandemic where, like, we needed to be able to listen to evidence really carefully? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
It was not. And I think this is this really, again, this messy space where what I was trying to do with this piece was to push back against what I felt like was an effort to kind of cast aside that year and to say that we now, looking back, we know the answers.
Mm-hmm.
We know this didn't work. We know everyone lied to you. We know that the public health establishment messed up. And I wanted to push back on that in a way of, as a way of opening up the conversation again,
yeah.
as a way of saying, no, these trade-offs still exist.
Yeah.
And my worry is that given the backlash that's happened against the public health sort of establishment and against a lot of these interventions, that the next time a pandemic comes, we will have the opposite.
Mm.
We will have a more viral pandemic that affects children, that is more deadly, and we will have become so convinced that these measures don't work and that we can't trust the public health community that we will start, we will have a culture that does the very opposite. That we will not even, we will fight the last war. And in doing so, we just won't fight the war at all.
Yeah.
And we will end up with actual catastrophe. Like, that's the reason I wrote it, was in the spirit, I think, of the argument
mm-hmm.
as a way of saying, like, no, we need to reopen this up. We can't just assume right, left, and center that restrictions don't work and that a pandemic response should be nothing. Like, we need to have these open debates as a society and do it in a better way. That at least was the hope, hopefully without making it seem like at the same time that, like, the public health response, the public health establishment's response during the pandemic was perfect or ideal or even good.
Well, since you opened that door, I do think the area where you are the most sympathetic to COVID revisionism is about schools.
Totally.
And so I'm hoping you can lay out for us what we know now and, like, I think that, like, the consensus that's building now that schools were closed too long and that they were closed too long and that at the expense in particular of children and in general, this, like, broader issue of generational debt that is building, like, as we become an aging society, right, you have a lot of our political power is contained within an older and older aging population, many of whom are very vulnerable. It doesn't mean that they're all, like, all powerful people, but, like, it's an aging society. We also have those people can vote in a way that children can't. They have a voice in the way that children can't. They have rationality, hopefully, in the way that children don't. And it creates, I mean, like, in terms of just, like, literal debt, like, when you take out a lot of, you know, we had an episode with Jordan Weissman recently about this, but, like, when you have a lot of, when you're running high deficits in a high interest rate environment, like, you're layering on the costs on younger people to pay that back.
Totally.
And who have to maybe have cuts to their benefits in order to pay that back, or cuts to the kinds of benefits and programs they would like to extend in order to pay that back. Then also just here.
Also, great, as an econ reporter, first and foremost, you really speak my language.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah. R versus G.
Get ready. But then, like, on top of that, too, just, like, young people sacrifice so much on behalf of the elderly. And I think that was not recognized. Like, it was treated as, we all need to do this to keep ourselves safe. Like, no, like, we were doing older people a solid. And I was happy to do it. Like, I wanted my father to be safe. I remember being very afraid that he was going to get COVID. I'm very afraid of, like, older people in my life being harmed by this illness. And just to me, like, it was not, like, a question that I would sacrifice to help protect them. But, like, let's not pretend like we were at the same level of risk.
Oh, yeah.
And so I guess, like, for you, like, you know, as you're thinking back on this, like, the biggest criticism you would have about public health, like, in education, like, how would you put that?
I think that this point around school closures and the sort of intergenerational dynamics of the pandemic are such an underexplored element of it. When I think about the biggest mistakes, keeping schools closed for as long as we did is the one that stands out first and foremost in my mind. Other kinds of harms are like really hard to quantify, like mm-hmm. how much social trust did the public health community lose by messaging hypocritically on George Floyd? Yeah. That's like, okay, we could try. But this one is like, we actually have the receipts where basically what happened was that like heading into the fall semester of 2020, you had 74 of the 100 largest school districts in the country did not open up for in-person learning. Only about 40% of schools nationwide offered an in-person only option. And now looking back, we know that was a mistake. We know that was a failure because we now know that that was a genuine mistake. Mm-hmm. It was a failure. We now know that the amount of learning loss that kids suffered mm-hmm. during the pandemic was large. And that learning loss, the years of schooling loss, fell disproportionately on poor and minority kids. Yeah. It just did.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the sort of mental health disorders, depression, anxiety, the spikes in these that happen a lot among younger teenagers and kids could be traced back to school closures.
Yeah.
So we know that this is incredibly harmful. And we also now know that schools were not the vectors of transmission, the super spreader vectors of transmission we thought they were.
Yeah.
So actually weren't this huge risk to the wider community.
Yeah.
And we know that children were not the most vulnerable to the virus. We actually know that deaths among children, at least in the first wave of the pandemic, were vanishingly rare.
Yeah.
And so looking back, it's like, wow.
What did we do all that for?
We actually caused a huge amount of harm for very, very few benefits. This is one of the areas where I think the argument is the strongest. Where I tend to depart is like why we did this.
Yes. I thought this was a great part of your article.
Yeah. Why we did this. And but I we can get into the sort of why part, but I definitely think that like this is the part where I find myself nodding along with the COVID revisionists the most.
Yeah. And I think that like one of my favorite parts of the article is when you go into the why, because I think there's this belief mm-hmm. that the reason we didn't close our schools, the reason we didn't reopen our schools fast enough is because it's a simple story of like teachers unions didn't want that to happen. And so as a result, they didn't open in mm-hmm. places where teachers unions were strong. And I don't think that's like there's like nothing to that story. I think that clearly was the case that teachers, sometimes for very good reasons, were afraid of the pandemic, because even if the kids weren't going to get sick, it's possible that they would get sick. And also at the same time, too, that there was a demands for hazard pay, which I think were extremely reasonable, and that people who were actually in the most in harm's way, particularly essential workers, were not getting hazard pay for the most part while we were all getting to sit at mm-hmm. home and like type on our computers. You know, I think that there's like some truth to the fact that there were pressures from teachers and teachers unions and professional unions to keep schools closed longer than they should have been. Totally. And also that in blue areas, these are often very progressive institutions and they're going to push for maximally COVID policy as a result of their mm-hmm. ideological views. But at the same time, like you point out that that's not really where the political pressure was coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really glad you bring up this point, because I feel like it's become, especially on the right and right-wing COVID revisionism, it's like, it was the teachers. It was the teachers' unions. They were self-serving. And I feel like the basic story from a lot of folks on the right is like, these teachers were really selfish. They were empowered through their unions and then backed up by liberals and progressives who didn't want to say no to them and ended up were the main people who caused a lot of this harm.
Yeah.
And that, again, it's that there are teachers' unions are like beating up on them is like a national pastime for the right. Yeah, so like this is they're an easy target. But then you actually dig into like what was the polling data saying at the time mm-hmm. about what people thought about schools. And there are not many people who will tell you that like in the spring of 2020 we shouldn't have closed schools. Like I think a lot of people are like, okay, we just had a pandemic hit. And
who knows
what's going to happen. Yeah. But then by the fall, it was like, okay, we should have had them reopen. But if you look at polling from the summer of 2020, heading into the fall of 2020, parents in almost every poll, pluralities or majorities of parents were in support of keeping schools closed. And that is, I think, a fact that like COVID revisionists have to wrestle with.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just that parents as a whole mm-hmm. were opposed to schools reopening. It is that actually the sort of low income and parents of color, whose kids, by the way, were often the ones who were hurt most by schools being closed, a lot of them, though, were the most terrified of schools reopening. And so one stat here is there was this one nationally representative poll from USC, the University mm-hmm. of Southern California, that found that a majority of low-income families believed that schools should remain closed for the entire 2020 to 2021 school year, compared to only 27% of the wealthiest families. There's another poll I have here from the Kaiser Family Foundation. When parents were asked which comes closer to your view, is it better for schools to open sooner so that parents and, you know, students don't experience learning loss, et cetera, or is it better for schools to open later to reduce the risk of COVID? Mm-hmm. 60% of parents said we should delay schools, including 76% of parents of color. Yeah. These were polls taken in the summer of 2020 when, you know, a lot of sort of like there is a lot of debate happening around at the time. But this point that it was teachers unions, it was teachers, or even just that it was like the liberal media, mm-hmm. like it was the liberal media and the public health establishment, because that's the more left wing version of this is it wasn't, don't blame the teachers unions. It was public health officials. It was the media that was sowing misinformation and fear.
Yeah.
If that was the case, then you wouldn't expect the low income folks who are the least likely to be hyper engaged with what the New York Times said the other day, like they wouldn't be the ones mostly opposed to it. I think this was largely a case of like people looking around in their own communities being terrified. The information at the time was very mixed. There was conflicting studies. There were also just like people dying. Like, and it just like in that sort of fog of war, fog of uncertainty, we ended up keeping them closed longer than we should have. But why we did that is a lot more complicated than it was the teachers.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I it made me think a lot about the phones debate going on right now, where one of the biggest hurdles to removing phones from schools is not even the kids. It's the parents. The parents want their kids to have phones in schools. And because, I mean, either they're afraid of stuff like, you know, school shootings, which, you know, I think it seems a little bit irrational to me. I don't know what you're going to do in that situation, but I understand like the impulse to want to have connection to your child. But also just like the ease at which parents have had developed in being able to contact their kid at any point during the day constantly. Yeah. And you'll hear from teachers that like, you'd be like, oh, why are you texting in class? Like, oh, it's my mom. My mom told me, my mom's texting me right now. And it's like, it literally is their mom. It's like, that's what's going on. And I find it like a very, very difficult democratic question as well, because obviously like these people, I mean, you have the right. I mean, we have very expansive parental rights in this country about of how we allocate control and protection and agency of children, like who gets to assign that. It's like it's parents. And I think for good reason. But at the same time, it's like, what do we do in these situations when there's clearly a bifurcation of interest? And also there's the uncertainty is also leading people to make risk averse decisions that are actually more risky than they realize. That like you think you're protecting your kid by keeping their phone with them, by making sure they stay out of school during COVID, et cetera. And you might have good reason to believe that, or at least reasons that you find reasonable. But in reality, like you have now maybe consigned your child to like learning loss they will not recover from. And so I don't know if we're gonna solve this, but I do think that like what I love about how much you talk about how you talk about this is just like wanting this to be more of a debate rather than just like, okay, now Roger's closing the door again on debate and saying this is the final answer. He's like, no, like these are difficult questions.
I love closing the door on debate.
You love closing the door on debate? Well, let's close the door on this debate right now.
Before we do, I feel like I have to just say like I think the trickiness of that democratic question of how you define the polity is so important, because to all that we've been talking about debate here, this was one of the questions on which there was actually the most robust debate.
Yeah.
One of the healthiest debates was around school closures.
Yeah.
There was a lot, and this is another thing the COVID revisionists, I think, miss, is like there were op-eds written, right, in the Washington Post and the Atlantic.
Yeah.
You know, that left-wing rag.
Yeah.
and in JAMA, the medical journal, and you know the National Academies of like Science, Medicine, and Engineering came out for school openings. So there were like a lot of elites on one side of this issue, a lot of elites on another side of the issue. parents on one side of the issue, parents on the other side of the issue. And that, even in a situation in which we had a lot of debate, it was like we still seemingly did not make the greatest decision. The one thing that we didn't have was that the people that were the most implicated were not part of the conversation at all. Mm-hmm. And one counterfactual I run in my head is like, can a debate ever be truly healthy? Can ever truly be live up to our pluralistic ideals when a group of people that is most implicated by it does not get to be in the debate at all? By most other metrics, that was a pretty healthy debate that we were having about school closures. We still had a terrible outcome. Would it have been better if kids had more of a voice? I think probably.
Give kids the voice. Give them a vote. No, I'll take, you know, what I think there's like the controversial parents to get to vote for their kids. Seems like it would have exacerbated the problem here. Well, Roger, always our last and final question. What is a take, an argument, a book that you've come across recently that you would really like to rail against right now?
Well, given that this entire conversation was about a set of takes and books that I was railing against, I'll go in a slightly different direction.
Okay.
I'll give you two. One is more professional, and my life as an economics reporter. The other is a little more personal. The professional one is, there is this view that has been a view since really the beginning of the Trump administration, which is the stock market will save us. And this has now become known as like taco theory. Like Trump will always chicken out. So Trump has this latent desire to keep the stock market going up. Mm-hmm. And so Trump will back down
from anything that
if it looks like it's going to tank the stock market. And this is sort of in additional to just be like empirically like kind of ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like the reason why this take bothers me so much is because it is inherently self-negating.
Mm.
Right. If you believe that the stock market and its fluctuations will stop Donald Trump from doing something, what you are betting on is that Donald Trump does something crazy, a bunch of people sell their stocks, the stock market falls, Donald Trump changes course. Mm-hmm. But if everyone believes already that Donald Trump is going to chicken out, no one is going to sell.
Yeah.
And so basically by believing that the stock market will always save us, you prevent the stock market from saving us because you're never going to get the kind of crash.
So you're not arguing against taco. You believe in the noble lie about taco.
I believe that the noble lie of taco is actually undermining taco.
Yeah.
Like Trump, as the worst kind of take is a take that like negates itself.
Yeah.
And by believing in taco, you are making it no longer true because now Donald Trump will not back down.
Yeah.
Because every time he goes to back down, if the stock market keeps doing fine, there's no reason for him to back down. So that's one that annoys me. The one that's a little bit more fun is we're as of this recording, I am getting married this weekend.
Oh my gosh. And
which is exciting.
And Roger is wearing his wedding blazer for us right now. That is how excited he was to join this podcast.
This is how excited I am for argumentation. Shutting down arguments. But sociologists often make this distinction between a cornerstone marriage and a capstone marriage. Mm-hmm. And the more conventional view of people in our generation of people today generally is the capstone idea, which is that marriage is kind of like the icing on the cake. It's like two individual people come into a marriage having lived their lives, building their careers, building up who they are. And then you take these two distinct separate lives that are more or less fulfilled and you merge them. Mm-hmm. And marriage is like the end game. It's the capstone. Mm-hmm. And that's the view of relationships and marriage. I think it's just inherent to a lot of us. Like I take care of what I pursue self-actualization first, and then marriage is what comes after. Mm-hmm. It's like the end point. But then there's this older idea that I always viewed as like very like retro and like this is so lame.
Yeah.
A cornerstone marriage, which is that marriage comes first, and it is through marriage that you become the person you're supposed to be. Yeah. It is through marriage, it is through that relationship that makes you the person that then can go on to do all those amazing things. And it was funny, as I was going to write my vows, I was thinking about this distinction and I was like, wow, I'm someone who's always bought the conventional wisdom about capstone marriages, and I've been in a cornerstone relationship. Me and my fiance, we've been together for 7.5 years.
Now you're just bragging.
No,
you're
doing this to brag. Since we were seniors in college.
Yeah.
And I would not be the person I am today.
Aww.
Without her, like without that relationship, it has like changed me in so many profound ways. And so I now find myself nodding along with the social conservatives and being like, let's go. Cornerstone marriages, cornerstone relationships.
Wow. Okay. So you've come out as a anti-COVID revisionist, but a pro-social conservative on this podcast. And yeah, we should just let people have contained multitudes on this podcast. You know? You have pluralism within you.
Oh, we all have pluralism within us.
Roger, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Drew. It's been so much fun.
The Arguments production team includes Ranjini Chakraborty, Isabella Pereira, Angela Tracy, Kate Crawford, and Eli Richman. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to hear more from The Argument, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.